This message is a presentation of Pinnacle Baptist Church and the preaching ministry of Pastor Ray McBerry. Other messages like this are available online at pinnaclebaptist.com. The church is located at 2517 High Falls Road in Griffin, Georgia. If you're in the area, we would love for you to visit us this Sunday. Now, here's today's message.
All right. Tonight we are in Genesis chapter number 41. So I'll give you just a moment to turn there. We're studying the life of Joseph right now, and I want to remind you that one of the things we said when we started the life of Joseph here in Genesis is that there are a number of parallels between Joseph and the Lord Jesus Christ. Many preachers have preached messages that show the similarities between the two, the comparisons between the two. And in many ways, Joseph is a type or a foreshadowing in the Old Testament of Jesus and his ministry in the New Testament. You, I'm sure, already see some of the similarities in the fact that he was betrayed by his own, those that were closest to him. We'll see some other similarities, I think, as we go through the rest of the life of Joseph, including tonight. But here we are in Genesis chapter number 41. Now, in the previous chapter, we saw that the baker and the butler were both thrown into prison there where Joseph was being held. In fact, Joseph had been put in charge of all the other prisoners there in the prison. And during that time, both the baker and the butler had a dream. They both had an odd dream, an unusual dream, on the same night. And the next morning, both of them were a little bit discomfited, not knowing what the dreams meant. And Joseph was able to interpret their dreams to them the next day. And the butler got good news. The word was that within 3 days, he was going to be restored to his position working for Pharaoh as the chief butler. And it came to pass, just as Joseph had interpreted the dream for him. The baker, however, did not fare quite as well. His dream, when Joseph gave him the interpretation, was that within 3 days, his head would be lifted up also, but not lifted up to restore him, but his head would be lifted up off his body, and he would be hanged by the neck. So that was not good news, but it came to fruition as well. And so Joseph's only request of the butler was that when he got back to his job and got back to working for his old boss, Pharaoh, that he would remember Joseph. And he got back to his job and promptly went back to work and did not give Joseph another thought until our story tonight. So, Genesis chapter 41, beginning in verse 1. And it came to pass at the end of 2 full years that Pharaoh dreamed, and behold, he stood by the river. So you can imagine Joseph, it was 2 years passing since he interpreted the dream for the butler and the butler got his job back. Joseph must have assumed the same thing you or I would assume, that this fellow's just forgotten me and I'm still here languishing in prison for something I did not do in a land that's not my home. But he continued to be faithful to God. And it says at the end of 2 full years, Pharaoh dreamed. Now remember, we started the story of Joseph where Joseph had some dreams and then he interpreted the dreams through the Lord's help for the butler and the baker. Now Pharaoh has a dream. Verse 2, and behold, there came up out of the river 7 well-favored kine and fat-fleshed, and they fed in a meadow. All right, what's a kine? K-I-N-E. It's a cow, that's right. I imagine you probably had some of those growing up, Brother Mike. Got some now. So these are 7 well-favored cattle, fat flesh. That means they're doing well. They've been well-fed. And they're there feeding in a meadow. Verse 3, and behold, 7 other kine came up after them out of the river, ill-favored and lean-fleshed. So these 7 cows that come up out of the river, they're not doing too well. They're lean. They're skinny. They don't look very healthy. It says, and they stood by the other kine upon the brink of the river. And the ill-favored and lean-fleshed kine did eat up the seven well-favored and fat kine. So Pharaoh awoke. So the seven lean cattle eat the seven healthy cattle. And that's when Pharaoh promptly awakes. That's, I guess you could say, somewhat of a nightmare. We see all this stuff on TV nowadays about zombies, zombie this and zombie that. This is almost like seven zombie cows, TR, eating seven healthy cows. And cannibals, that's right. So it was enough of a bad dream that Pharaoh woke up in the middle of the night. And he slept and dreamed the second time. And behold, seven ears of corn came up upon one stalk, rank and good, that is, they were healthy ears of corn. And behold, seven thin ears, and blasted with the east wind, sprung up after them. So here you have one stalk. There's seven good ears of corn that come out on this stalk. And then there's seven ears that come out on the stalk that are thin. They're kind of shriveled up. The kernels aren't full. They're not developed. They're not something you'd want to take off the corn stalk and eat. In other words, they look pretty bad. And the seven thin ears devoured the seven rank and full ears. And Pharaoh awoke, and behold, it was a dream. So now he's had two dreams in the same night, both dealing with sevens. Seven healthy cows, seven not so healthy cows that devoured the healthy ones. Seven ears of corn that were very healthy, and seven that were not healthy, and they ended up devouring the seven healthy ears of corn. So two nightmares of sort, and he woke up from both of them. And it came to pass in the morning that his spirit was troubled, and he sent and called for all the magicians of Egypt and all the wise men thereof. And Pharaoh told them his dream, but there was none that could interpret them unto Pharaoh. Now, I want to stop for just a moment and talk about these magicians. The magicians here are the same type of men, the same job description as what we find in the book of Daniel when King Nebuchadnezzar calls all his magicians and wise men and Chaldeans to him to interpret the dreams that he had before Daniel gave him the interpretation. These magicians were men that would have been well-versed in the ancient lore and mythology of Babylon. Now, here we are in Egypt, but these that are in Egypt, the religion, the mythology, and the practice of using the stars for divination, all of them with their secret knowledge and mysteries were brought over from the Tower of Babel when everybody was forced to spread out, when God came down at the Tower of Babel and confounded their languages. Everything that we find in ancient Egypt related to their culture, their religion, their mythology, it is all just like that from ancient Babylon. It just has different names once it's brought over to Egypt. But the same religion is there that we find in ancient Babylon, the same with the Baal worship of the Canaanites in the land where Israel ended up dwelling, and the same with all those other places throughout the ancient world. Remember, when they left the ancient city of Babel, when God confounded the languages, everywhere they went, they took with them the false religion of Nimrod, who builded the city of Babylon and the Tower of Babel. So these magicians are the same job description as those back in ancient Babylon. They were astrologers. That is, they tried to divine or tell people's fortunes, read the stars, just like the palm reader would try to read somebody's palm today. They were fortune tellers of sorts. They were not magicians in the sense that they pulled rabbits out of hats, but they were supposedly the keepers of secret special knowledge that no one else knew. And so that's the group of people he calls in, these people that supposedly can tell you things that nobody else can tell you. But he calls them in, tells them the dream, and unfortunately for his sake, nobody could interpret the dreams for Pharaoh. Verse 9, Then spake the chief butler unto Pharaoh, saying, I do remember my faults this day. Pharaoh was wroth with his servants and put me in ward in the captain of the guard's house, both me and the chief baker. So he's reminding Pharaoh, I remember a couple of years ago I got in trouble and you put me in prison right along with the chief baker. I'm sure this isn't the kind of thing he wanted to bring up to Pharaoh. You don't ever like to remind somebody that they had to get on to you at some point. But that's what he's doing here. He's reminding Pharaoh. But he's got a reason for doing that. He says in verse 11, and we dreamed a dream in one night, I and he. We dreamed each man according to the interpretation of his dream. And there was with us, there was with us a young man, an Hebrew, servant to the captain of the guard. And we told him, and he interpreted to us our dreams. To each man according to his dream he did interpret. And it came to pass, as he interpreted to us, so it was. Me he restored unto mine office, and him he hanged. Notice here the wording that the butler uses. The butler says that Joseph interpreted the dreams, and he says, me he restored unto mine office, and him he hanged. He says it as though Joseph is the one that had the other man hanged, and Joseph is the one that restored him to his office. Now, if you're Pharaoh and you're listening to this, I'm sure what would be crossing my mind is, listen, that man in the prison there, he's not the one that did those things. I did those things. But the message that the butler is communicating is that this man is in touch with the gods, and he was able to tell me what was going to happen. It was not you, O Pharaoh, that made those choices. It was the gods, and this man told me before it happened what was going to happen. So I think the butler at this point, he realizes there's something special about Joseph, not just that he was able to interpret what the dreams meant, but that he must somehow have some special connection to the gods. And of course, the Egyptians, just like the Babylonians and others, believed in more than one god and goddess. But he knows that there's something supernatural about Joseph. And by the way, those magicians that were called into Pharaoh, you know, they could have just given Pharaoh a guess as to the interpretation of his dream, but I think there's probably a good reason they didn't do that. What would be the danger of guessing the interpretation to Pharaoh? Yes, when your interpretation didn't pan out, you probably weren't going to fare very well. So I think that's the reason that these magicians did not try to just con the Pharaoh into believing something that was not so. We know in the book of Daniel what the king did to those who made something up, and it was not so. He had them disposed of, they and their families as well. I imagine these men in Egypt were smart enough. They figured out we better not make something up. So that's why they just said, we don't know. So the butler now has told Pharaoh about the story in the prison. Verse 14. Then Pharaoh sent and called Joseph, and they brought him hastily out of the dungeon. And he shaved himself and changed his raiment and came in unto Pharaoh. Says he shaved himself. I imagine he had a lot of facial hair after being in prison there for who knows how long. And so he cleaned himself up, was freshly shaven, and he came in before Pharaoh after he had cleaned himself up. And Pharaoh said unto Joseph, I have dreamed a dream, and there is none that can interpret it. And I have heard say of thee that thou canst understand a dream to interpret it. And Joseph answered Pharaoh, saying, it is not in me. God shall give Pharaoh an answer of peace. We see right away Joseph is very careful to give God the credit for the fact he was able to tell the butler and the baker the interpretation of their dreams. And he is telling Pharaoh, whatever God reveals to me about your dream is going to be from the Lord too. You know, we all should be careful to give God the glory and the credit for the gifts, talents, and abilities that He's given to us. I can think of at least one example in the New Testament of someone that was a silver tongue orator, a great speaker. And the people praised him and said he spoke like a god. And he took the credit for it instead of giving God the credit. And he fell over dead, eaten with worms on the inside. Who was that, remember? In the New Testament, the book of Acts? He was one of the Herods, that's exactly right. And so we need to be careful to give God the credit and the glory for the gifts, the talents, and abilities that he gives to us. And if we are not careful to give him the credit for them, I think we should not be surprised if he withdraws those gifts, talents, and abilities from us. So you say, preacher, I don't have any gifts or talents or abilities. Oh, yes, you do. We all have gifts of the Spirit, and whatever yours is, you ought to figure out what it is and then put it to good use for the Lord. Yes, sir?
But if you give God the credit for healing, he can keep that healing up or he can withdraw it again.
That's a good point, Brother Mike. You're exactly right. Look at verse 17. And Pharaoh said unto Joseph, in my dream, behold, I stood upon the bank of the river. And behold, there came up out of the river seven kine, fat-fleshed and well-favored, and they fed in a meadow. And behold, seven other kine came up after them, poor and very ill-favored and lean-fleshed, such as I never saw in all the land of Egypt for badness. And the lean and the ill-favored kind did eat up the first seven fat kine. And when they had eaten them up, it could not be known that they had eaten them, but they were still ill-favored. As at the beginning, so I awoke. And I saw in my dream, and behold, seven ears came up in one stalk, full and good. And behold, seven ears, withered, thin, and blasted with the east wind, sprung up after them. And the thin ears devoured the seven good ears. And I told this unto the magicians, but there was none that could declare it to me. I noticed the first thing here is right after Joseph said, God will give Pharaoh an answer of peace. Pharaoh doesn't, at least as far as recorded, Pharaoh doesn't make any comment about that. He just goes right into what his dream was. Whether Pharaoh was discounting what Joseph said or not, he just goes right to business. He goes right to telling him what the dream was. I strongly suspect that here is Joseph, who's a Hebrew, a Pharaoh being an Egyptian, with all of the intricate beliefs of the Egyptian religion, he probably didn't think very much of the God of the Hebrews. After all, the Hebrews, to the Egyptians, were just some small nomadic group that lived over here in what is called the Levant, the area of Canaan. To the civilized, cultured Egyptians, the Hebrews were nobody. They were just backward pagans living out in the desert somewhere. He probably had little regard for the God of the Hebrews. So when Joseph said, God will reveal it to Pharaoh, I think he probably just discounted that, and he was only interested in what was the interpretation of the dream without giving much thought to Joseph's God. Verse 25, and Joseph said unto Pharaoh, the dream of Pharaoh is one. God hath showed Pharaoh what he is about to do. The seven good kine are 7 years, and the seven good ears are 7 years. The dream is one, and the seven thin and ill-favored kine that came up after them are 7 years. And the seven empty ears blasted with the east wind shall be 7 years of famine. This is the thing which I have spoken unto Pharaoh. What God is about to do, he showeth unto Pharaoh. Does God ever speak in the Bible to lost people? He certainly does. T.R.? T.R. mentions the story of Nebuchadnezzar in the book of Daniel. So There are multiple examples in the Old Testament of God speaking even to lost people, and it's because He's telling them what is going to come to pass. Number one, because God wants them to be converted. He wants them to believe upon Him also. But God is working even through unbelievers to work out His will for His own people. You know, that's true in my life and your life too. I can think of times in my own life where God I'm quite certain of it, did things in the lives of unsaved people around me because He was looking after me. And I think that's what He's doing with Joseph and with the rest of the children of Israel, though they're back in the land of Canaan at this point and don't know that's what He's doing. But I think that's true in God's dealings with mankind. If you belong to Him, there's no extent to which God will not go on your behalf. Isn't it refreshing and encouraging to know that? Especially in the evil world in which we live.
Even though I'm not saved, I'm in Scripture that says God would that all men will be saved.
That's exactly right. God's not willing that any should perish. There's definitely hope, just as there was hope for Pharaoh here. And just as Nebuchadnezzar could have hoped, and I believe that Nebuchadnezzar ended up getting saved there in the book of Daniel. But here we see Pharaoh, Joseph says, what God is about to do, He showeth unto Pharaoh. Verse 29, behold, there come 7 years of great plenty throughout all the land of Egypt. And there shall arise after them 7 years of famine. And all the plenty shall be forgotten in the land of Egypt. And the famine shall consume the land. And the plenty shall not be known in the land by reason of that famine following. For it shall be very grievous. Now, I've drawn on the whiteboard here the same map that you're all familiar with. You've seen me draw it 100 times. The Nile River here in the land of Egypt is considered the life of Egypt. As far back as there has been civilization in Egypt, it has always been centered along the banks of the Nile. The Nile River not only provides fresh water for the people in Egypt, it provides the silt that comes down out of the mountains at the origin of the Nile, which would be somewhere down here, and it brings those deposits of rich soil that is deposited all along the banks of the Nile and, of course, at the Nile Delta at the mouth of the river as it runs into the Mediterranean. So, the Nile River was the source of life in Egypt. Here, the land of Egypt, that was known as the breadbasket of the ancient world, Pharaoh has just been told there are coming 7 good years, followed by 7 years of famine. I doubt that anyone who lived in Egypt would have believed that there would be 7 years of famine in the land of Egypt. It was just almost impossible to believe because year after year after year, when the flood waters would recede, the rich soil that was deposited all along the banks of the Nile River and at the mouth there in the Nile Delta, it provided enough food, more than enough food, for all the people of Egypt and for them to sell grain to people all around the ancient world that came to Egypt to buy food. I'm sure it was very hard for anybody, least of all Pharaoh, to believe there were going to be 7 years in a row where there were crop failures in the land of Egypt. That would have been unheard of to Pharaoh, I'm sure. Verse 32. And for that the dream was doubled unto Pharaoh twice. It is because the thing is established by God, and God will shortly bring it to pass. Joseph said, you dreamed that twice because God was telling you this is going to happen. Now, when God says something one time, it's important. But if He says something twice, it's doubly important. And if He dare say it 3 times to us, we ought to sit up and take notice of it. One of the things I find interesting in those modern English versions of the Bible There are numerous verses, of course, that are totally removed from the New Testament in particular, and many of them have to do with important doctrines of the Bible. They're not verses that are just kind of in between major doctrines. One of those doctrines that those modern versions leave out are verses about hell, which is a real place, a literal place. In Mark chapter 9, verses 42, 44, and 46, in our King James Bible, there are three different times that God says the same thing about hell. He says, "Where their worm dieth not, and the fire is not quenched." Now, he says it three times, the same words over and over and over in three separate verses within five verses. Now, if God says something once, it's important. If he says it twice, it's doubly important. And if he says it three times, we certainly ought to take notice of it.
That's God's volume control.
Yeah, I think your preacher is right. Well, you know, the modern versions take out two of those instances in Mark chapter 9 that have that verse. And the defenders of these modern English versions all say, well, see, it's left in there one of the three times, so what are you upset about? Why does it matter? Well, it matters, number one, because if you're taking away anything from God's Word, you're monkeying with God's Word, which is something we're not supposed to do anyway. But the second reason is that if God said it three times within five verses, it's because God wanted it in there three times within five verses. And it's to get our attention. And so that's just another example, I think, of those modern versions there where, again, God said something multiple times because he's trying to get our attention. And that's exactly what Joseph just said to Pharaoh. It's because this thing is going to come true. God will bring it to pass. Verse 33. Now, therefore, let Pharaoh look out a man, discreet and wise, and set him over the land of Egypt. Let Pharaoh do this, and let him appoint officers over the land, and take up the fifth part of the land of Egypt in the seven plenteous years, and let them gather all the food of those good years that come, and lay up corn under the hand of Pharaoh, and let them keep food in the cities. And that food shall be for store to the land against the 7 years of famine, which shall be in the land of Egypt, that the land perish not through the famine. All right, so what Joseph suggests is that, number one, Pharaoh put a man in charge of collecting enough stored up food over the seven good years that there would be food to feed everybody during the seven bad years that would follow. So number one, appoint a man to be in charge of it. Number two, appoint officers in all the cities to make sure this is done properly. If you fail to prepare during the seven good years, there'd be no way to make up for that during the seven bad years. You have to prepare now. By the way, that's a good lesson for all of us in our lives too. And the other thing I wanted to point out here is that the amount that he said that they should put aside was how much? 20%. In other words, there would be a 20% tax on all the food produced for the next seven good years. Now, not a tax in money or coins or gold or silver, but in the amount of the food. So if you had seven bushels of corn, if you had 10 bushels of corn, two of those would be brought and turned in as your taxes, and they would be put in a silo somewhere, so they would be preserved for that 7 years when there would be no food. I say that simply to say this. This was a situation where it was a crisis, an emergency situation. Notice that even in the worst of situations, God's prescription for the government to take care of the people, even in a catastrophic emergency, was a 20% tax. At what rate are we taxed in America today if you add up our local taxes, state taxes, federal taxes, all those other hidden taxes that are figured in? I don't remember exactly what the amount is, but I think it comes up to somewhere close to 40% of what the average American brings in every year goes to one kind of tax or another nowadays. In a catastrophic situation, God said 20% ought to be just fine. Normally, God only asks 10% of our income to take care of things. I've always thought if 10% was good enough for God, it ought to be good enough for Uncle Sam, too. Uncle Sam doesn't seem to see it that way, but I just think it's interesting that even in a catastrophic emergency, 20% is what God recommended, and yet our government wants way, way, way more than that from us today. I think that is some indication that there's some unscrupulous things going on today. All right, I'll get off the politics there and move on. Verse 37, "And the thing was good in the eyes of Pharaoh and in the eyes of all his servants. And Pharaoh said unto his servants, Can we find such a one as this, a man in whom the Spirit of God is? And Pharaoh said unto Joseph, For as much as God hath showed thee all this, there is none so discreet and wise as thou art. Thou shalt be over my house, and according unto thy word shall all my people be ruled. Only in the throne will I be greater than thou." So here's Joseph, just taken up out of the dungeon that morning or the night before, and now he's being told by Pharaoh that in all the land of Egypt, the only one who will be greater than Joseph will be Pharaoh himself. Joseph's head has been lifted up and in the way of the butler. And Pharaoh said unto Joseph, "See, I have set thee over all the land of Egypt." And Pharaoh took off his ring from his hand and put it upon Joseph's hand and arrayed him in vestures of fine linen and put a gold chain about his neck. Now, what was the significance of the ring?
Authority.
His authority? Power? That everything you all have just said is exactly right. Power, authority, the ability to make decisions. Yes, sir? That's right. That's where I was going with that, Brother Jim. That was the king's signet ring. And that meant that Joseph could make whatever proclamation that he wanted to make to put all this into place, to put it into effect, to make it happen. He could write the laws, and all he had to do was take that ring that Pharaoh had given him and press it into the hot wax to seal those legal documents with the king's signet ring, and that meant that it was the same as Pharaoh making the law. Pharaoh gave Joseph the authority to make the laws of Egypt as his right-hand man. Well, it's quite a promotion from dungeon to being able to make the laws of the land in a place where you're not even from. But that was the significance of the ring. Of course, the fine linen would have shown his prestige, and the gold chain about his neck, again, power and authority, just as you all have said already. Again, very reminiscent of what was given to Daniel there the night that the handwriting on the wall wrote in the plaster during the feast. Verse 43, "And he made him to ride in the second chariot which he had." This would have been the equivalent of giving him the second stretch limo, not the number one stretch limo, but the number two stretch limo. It says, "And they cried before him, Bow the knee. And he made him ruler over all the land of Egypt. And Pharaoh said unto Joseph, I am Pharaoh, and without thee shall no man lift up his hand or foot in all the land of Egypt." And Pharaoh saying, you have my authority. Whatever you say is the law of the land. Whatever you say goes. And Pharaoh called Joseph's name Zaphnath-Paaneah, and he gave him to wife Asenath, the daughter of Potipharah, priest of On. And Joseph went out over all the land of Egypt. All right, several names here that we want to get. The first one is the name that Pharaoh gave to Joseph. Zaphnath-Paneah. Linguists are not in agreement as to what this name means. The vast majority of linguists and Bible scholars alike say that it probably means he who interprets dreams or he who interprets mysteries. Something along the line of he that is able to reveal mysteries, the unknown, the hidden, is what most people say. There are some who say that the last part of the name there, Paneah, has to do with life. And so there are some linguists who say that this actually means something about he who gives life. And that certainly could be the possibility too, because by directing them to put aside food for the 7 good years so they would not starve in the last 7 years, he certainly preserved their life. So there could be something to that as well. I'm not enough of a linguist to know which of the two it is or if it's something else, but those are the two most well-known suggested interpretations of the name. But it says that Pharaoh also gave him a wife. He gave him a wife whose name was Asenath. Her name means daughter of the goddess Neith, N-E-I-T-H, one of the Egyptian goddesses in their pantheon of gods and goddesses. So this girl was named after one of the Egyptian goddesses. I think there's a good reason she was named after one of the goddesses of Egypt, because she was the daughter, it says, of Potipharah. Now, this is not Potiphar that we saw before. I have read there are some preachers who have tried to say that this is the same Potiphar who was captain of the guard that Joseph worked for when he first was brought to Egypt. I do not believe that to be the case. You can certainly do your own reading and studying and decide what you think. But this man, Potipharah, his name means the same thing as the Potiphar that we saw at the beginning of Joseph's story in Egypt. But I think it's a different man. It says here he is the priest of On, O-N. We've had the city Ur, now we've got the city of On. Now, up here on the map, I want to show you where On is located, and I want to talk about the significance of it, because the significance of the city of On plays into, well, the rest of the history of the children of Israel for the rest of the Old Testament in general, and specifically when we study the book of Exodus, it plays into it. The capital of the kingdom of Egypt at this time was Memphis, that would have been located somewhere around there. Now, this is not Memphis where Graceland is. This is Memphis in Egypt, not Tennessee. All of us Southerners are very familiar with the other Memphis, because that's where the other king lived, right? So the city of On, however, was located almost where this right tributary of the Nile flowed into the main branch of the Nile there. So this is the city of On, O-N. The city of On was also known in history by another name later on when the Greeks and the Romans conquered Egypt. The name that the Greeks called this city was Heliopolis. The word polis, of course, as you know, just means city. Helio refers to what? The sun. So this was the sun city, the city of the sun god. The sun god, at least the way that the Egyptians referred to him, was Amun-Ra, or just Ra. Sometimes you see it R-A, sometimes you see it R-E. It's the sun god. Now, for those that were part of our study on Mystery Babylon a couple of years ago when we talked about the religion developed at the Tower of Babel, you'll remember the story that Nimrod, when he was killed and cut into pieces, his wife Semiramis claimed that she put all the pieces back together and he was resurrected, brought back to life, and that he ascended up into the heavens and became one with the sun, that Nimrod became the sun god. That's why all of the ancient civilizations, ancient cultures, when they were spread out from Babel, they all took with them the worship of the sun as their number one deity, their number one god. In every ancient religion around the world, when they scattered from Babel, they all took with them the worship of the sun god and the moon goddess. It's because they learned it from the worship there at the Tower of Babel. But their solar deity, their sun god, was Ra, or Amun-Ra. And this city was his city, Heliopolis, the city of the sun god. This is where Joseph's father-in-law lived. He was the priest in the temple to the sun god in the city of Heliopolis, or as we see it called here, On. Now, there's more significance to this, however, and I want to just briefly mention this because within just another week or two in our adult Sunday school class on Sunday mornings, we're going to begin going through the book of Exodus. This is important, and I'll probably mention some of this again for those that aren't here tonight that might be in our Sunday school class, but this figures prominently into the story of Exodus because always in all of those ancient cultures, the worship of the sun god was in part conducted through using prize bulls as part of the worship of the sun god. Bulls, B-U-L-L-S. I mentioned this morning in pretty good depth when we were in the morning worship service talking about the worship of Baal. You remember in the story of Gideon in the book of Judges, how that when God told Gideon, before you go out and fight the Amalekites, I want you to do something for me. And he told him to go cut down the grove of trees, tear down the altar of Baal, and kill the number two prized bull that was used in the worship of Baal. Why were there bulls associated with the worship of Baal? Well, as in all the ancient cultures, the horns were symbols of power and authority. Even in Scripture, in the book of Daniel, for example, when we read the dreams and the visions that Daniel has, we know that horns are a symbol of power and authority. Well, the bulls were seen as part of the worship of the sun god because they were a perception of a visible, physical entity that could be seen as a representative of the power and authority of the sun god. That's why in every ancient culture, everywhere around the world, when you see the worship of the sun, you will see some form, some manifestation of worshiping the sun god through some animal that has horns. In Egypt, it was the bulls. And at this temple in the city of On, they literally raised prize bulls there like it was an FFA project going on there. Sometimes these bulls were the Apis bulls. Then there were the Minervus bulls. But they were raised as prize bulls, and once or twice a year, they would hold parades and festivals in honor of the sun god, and they would put ribbons and streamers on these prize bulls and parade them through the city. And the people would give gifts to the bull, as silly as that sounds, because it was their way of worshiping or honoring the sun god, not the bull. These prize bulls were treated better than people were, by the way. And whenever they died, these prize bulls in Egypt were literally mummified and buried in catacombs there in Heliopolis, the city of On, just like pharaohs were in the pyramids. They were mummified and specially preserved because these were the holy bulls that were used to worship the sun god Ra. In the land of Canaan, it was done the same way in the worship of Baal, who was considered the sun god, the sky god. That's why Gideon was told to kill the number two prize bull when he cut down the groves and tore down the altar of Baal. In India, even to this day, the Hindus, they don't allow anyone to kill those Brahma bulls that have the big horns because they are considered a manifestation of their gods on earth as well. The Greeks, in their mythology, had the Minotaurs, a man's body with the head of a bull with horns. The Moabites and Ammonites that lived near Israel, they worshiped Molech and Chemosh, and they offered child sacrifices to them. Again, those were manifestations of the sun god that had, they were always portrayed with a man's body and the head of a bull with horns. So this worship of the sun god using horned animals is in every ancient culture around the world. Why are they all the same? It's because they all came from the same place. They all came from the Tower of Babel before God scattered them to all the four corners of the world. Most of the time, it was associated with, it was bulls associated with the worship of the sun god. Occasionally, it would be goats because they have horns. In fact, even today, witchcraft, Satanists, they use the image that's called Baphomet. It has, from the neck down, it's the body of a human, half man and half woman. And from the neck up, it's the head of a goat with the long goat horns on it. That's the symbol called Baphomet. By the way, that's also, I'm not going to make the symbol with my hand, but that's the symbol that rock stars flash, the horns, when they put the thumb up and the pinky up, making the symbol of the horns. But it's not just rock stars that do it. I can show you pictures of rock stars and movie stars doing it. I can also show you pictures of George Bush doing it, Bill Clinton doing it, the Pope doing it, the crazy fella from Iran that was unelected before the current leader took power. So all these people around the world, when they flash that sign with the horns sticking up, it's a symbol of Satan. And that's why that is associated with the worship of the sun god, which is nothing different than Satan himself. I mentioned this morning in the sermon, so for those of you that were here, forgive me. I'm rehashing some of what we talked about this morning. But Baal is another name for Satan. Jesus in the New Testament referred to Satan by the name of Beelzebub. The word Beel is the name is the same as the word Baal, Zebub. Jesus used the name of Baal to be synonymous with Satan himself. So it's Satan worship. But the worship of bulls and goats to honor Satan goes right hand in hand with that. And even the horned owl is a symbol of Satan. I won't go into a lot of that tonight because that's not what this is about, but a lot of the Disney cartoons and all have horned owls in them and sometimes in kind of eerie situations. All of these are symbology of Baal worship or what is in Egypt, the worship of the sun god, but it's really Satan worship is all it is, in different manifestations by different names. So I'm coming back to why I was telling you all of that. The children of Israel, before we get out of the book of Genesis, they're going to come down, and the part of Egypt where they're going to live is this eastern part of the Nile Delta. What's this land called? The children of Israel lived in the land of Goshen, that's right. Good job, Brother Lawrence. The land of Goshen. The land of Goshen was right adjacent to, and some say even included, the city of Heliopolis. So when the children of Israel are down at the foot of Mount Sinai after they leave Egypt, and they don't think Moses is ever coming back down the mountain because he's been up there for 40 days, and they talk Aaron into making them a golden calf. The reason they're familiar with the worship of the golden calf from back in Egypt is because the center of the worship of the golden calf was right there in their backyard where they lived when they were in the land of Egypt. They were very familiar with it. So what they were saying to Aaron when they asked him to make them a golden calf to worship was, Aaron, we want to go back to Egypt. Our hearts are still back there. We don't want to be out here in the middle of the desert. We'd rather be slaves in Egypt and enjoy the pleasures of sin for a season, as the book of Hebrews chapter 11 tells us. But here's the city of On. It's called the city of Heliopolis. It was the center of worship for the sun god Ra, and he was primarily worshipped through these sacred bulls that were raised and housed right there. All right, I need to continue on so that I can get us through the chapter. By the way, the word Potiphar has to do with the worship of Ra, the sun god. Verse 46, and Joseph was 30 years old when he stood before Pharaoh, king of Egypt. There's another comparison between Joseph and Jesus. When Jesus began his public ministry, he was about 30 years old. It says, and Joseph went out from the presence of Pharaoh and went throughout all the land of Egypt. And in the 7 plenteous years, the earth brought forth by handfuls. And he gathered up all the food of the 7 years which were in the land of Egypt, and laid up the food in the cities. The food of the field, which was round about every city, laid he up in the same. And Joseph gathered corn as the sand of the sea, very much, until he left numbering, for it was without number. One of the things I want to stop here and say before I continue on, just quickly, they have found in excavated archaeological sites there in Egypt some grain silos, some vaults, rather, that instead of being built above ground, they were built down into the ground. Huge, huge vaults dug down into stone there in the land of Egypt. And you'll have to go online and look this up so you can see the images for yourself. But the vaults were literally dug down into the stone so that the grains that were put down in there would be preserved. There was no moisture that was going to get to them. The temperature was constant year-round, and it would literally last for years and years down in these vaults, dug down into the stone, going hundreds of feet down into the ground there in Egypt. The pictures do a better service to it than my description. I encourage you, go online and look that up using your favorite search engine to do that. Verse 50 says, and unto Joseph were born 2 sons before the years of famine came, which Asenath, the daughter of Potipharah, priest of On, bare unto him. And Joseph called the name of the firstborn Manasseh. For God, said he, hath made me forget all my toil and all my father's house. So the name Manasseh means forgetful. That is, God made me forget all of my sorrow that came before this. And the name of the second called he Ephraim. For God hath caused me to be fruitful in the land of my affliction. So the name Ephraim means fruitful. So forgetful and fruitful. Those are his 2 boys. Verse 53, and the 7 years of plenteousness that was in the land of Egypt were ended. And the 7 years of dearth began to come, according as Joseph had said. And the dearth was in all lands, but in all the land of Egypt there was bread. And when all the land of Egypt was famished, the people cried to Pharaoh for bread. And Pharaoh said unto all the Egyptians, go unto Joseph, what he saith to you, do. And the famine was over all the face of the earth. This was a worldwide famine, not just a little localized one in Egypt. And Joseph opened all the storehouses and sold unto the Egyptians. And the famine waxed sore in the land of Egypt. And all countries came into Egypt to Joseph for to buy corn, because that the famine was so sore in all lands. This was a worldwide catastrophe. But because God gave Pharaoh the dream, and Pharaoh gave Joseph the opportunity to interpret the dream, and then was obedient to the interpretation, Egypt was spared. And God's going to use Egypt and Pharaoh and Joseph to do a great miracle for the rest of the children of Israel that we'll see, Lord willing, in the next chapter. Well, I know that you already were probably familiar with the story we covered tonight. Hopefully you got some new information that you didn't already know that added to your understanding of the story. Any questions or comments before we finish for tonight?